This is the Analyzing Anfield podcast on the Blood Red Channel, bringing you the best tactical and statistical analysis of Liverpool FC.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Analyzing Anfield, your tactics and analytics podcast, courtesy of the Blood Red Channel. I'm your host, Josh Williams, and I'm joined as ever by David Hughes. Dave, how are we doing?
I am okay, thank you, Josh. I've got nothing to add on that. Well, it's long, isn't it? Let's be honest. I was going to do the cat today. I put it off another week, but I've been talking to my other half. I've been saying to her, look, do us a favour and just shave it all off for me. But she's insisting that I've got a bit of a, what's the term, a P-head. She's saying that the hair kind of beeps it out a little bit. So, we'll have to address it at some point this week, I think, because, you know, barbers aren't opening anytime soon. But from a football's perspective, mate, not too bad.
I mean, I'm a little bit worse and the hair's getting out of hand, but so is Liverpool's form. Liverpool, another two losses, which is it's kind of unprecedented, I suppose, for this podcast, at least. Since we last spoke, we obviously previewed Burnley, thought things would return to normal. They definitely didn't. And then Liverpool faced United in the FA Cup. We didn't preview that game. We don't usually focus on our domestic clubs, but Liverpool lost again. So the last time Liverpool had what you would label as a standard win was probably over a month ago, before Christmas, Crystal Palace, yeah. The 7-0 win. I'm not really going to include the 4-1 win over Aston Villa under 13s. Doesn't really count, does it? But other than that, you know, we're pretty much winless. It's a weird period. So today we're going to touch on what happened against Burnley and United. I suppose we could combine the two. And then we're going to look ahead to Spurs on Thursday. And we have West Ham on the Sunday, which we're also going to address in this podcast. But yeah, I mean, we'll start with Burnley, Dave. I think the Burnley game is probably the most concerned I've got. I've tried throughout this weird run to keep my feet on the ground, and it can happen. As weird as it is, it can happen. And there's been a very low probability throughout that Liverpool will have come out the opposite end of this with zero goals. But I think after the Burnley game, that's probably the most concerned I've been. In fact, I think after it, I went for a drive, pick up a little Maggie's, and I gave you a bell. I remember giving you a bell just to see what your thoughts were, because you know, I could have tuned into TalkSport, but you know, that's not me. That, so I don't know. Have you changed your thoughts since? Have you, you know, what do you think?
Not really. No, you know, we kind of talked about it, didn't we, straight after the game? And bear in mind, I'd just been watching the game live. I'd had no commentary or nothing. I'd just basically been watching on the pitch. And my initial thoughts were, in terms of those forward positions in the attacking third, it just felt like there was a lack of responsibility amongst the attackers. And I said that to you, didn't I? It feels like if the easier option was to attempt a quick cross into the box, then that's what happens. You know, Alexander-Arnold did that a fair bit, didn't he? If you could potentially produce something, maybe a dribble or something a bit surprise and catch the opposition off guard, it just didn't happen. You know, it just felt like it was all very monotonous, playing safe, just kind of not going through the motions, because there was definitely an ambition to score, but just felt like there was this kind of just very staged, sequenced and pretty easy to defend against. I know, which we'll probably run through in a minute, but I know the Liverpool had a much higher XG on the day, but you know, if you have a look at the shot map, beyond that Origi chance, which, you know, you'd argue was definitely Liverpool's best chance and probably one he should have scored. Beyond that, it was all just, you know, pot shots with very, very low quality. And you'd have to say, you couldn't really make an argument beyond that Origi one that Liverpool deserved to score on the day.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like the first game really whereby Liverpool's attack did feel broken in a way, and it was hard to pinpoint exactly why. We were repeatedly trying the same things, and it clearly wasn't working. Trent, I've got to a point where I felt sorry for him, because he was just, it just felt like he was relentlessly doing things that, I suppose, last season players were getting on the end of. But this time around, he was either hitting the first man or hitting, you know, a Burnley centre back, and it's kind of bread and butter for Burnley centre backs, crosses into the box, especially when there's either not enough bodies in the box or not enough players moving in the box or all that. So it did get to a point, maybe around the hour mark, where, you know, I was just thinking, what's going on here? Like, this does genuinely feel like, I don't know, it felt like maybe the same match had been on repeat for about 5 hours. In terms of the Burnley game being similar to West Brom, being similar to Newcastle. And I did think that this would maybe be the game for it to change a little bit. And it just, you know, it didn't. And it just felt a bit more serious for me. I mean, not massive. I mean, I did tweet during the game that the worst I was going to get would be mildly concerned, I think is the way I phrased it. But even that, I wouldn't have expected, you know, recently.
No. I mean, I think it's important to point out that our main concern is the attack, isn't it? Because I know Liverpool obviously lost the game, and it was quite an expensive loss because they obviously, you know, that record that they had in terms of not losing a home Premier League match is gone now. But it was basically, for me, it was a 0-0 game, wasn't it? But when the game is in the balance like that, Liverpool have been so good in the past of putting the game out of reach in terms of the elements that can impact it. You know, the unpredictables like a penalty, red card stuff. Liverpool have been great of kind of distancing themselves between that and the risk of those things happening. But when you're leaving games in the balance like a 0-0 here, you're then open to these, you know, rare elements of a conceding a penalty. And obviously that's why it ended up being a loss instead of a draw. But, you know, on the surface, it was a 0-0 performance that ended up in a defeat because of a bit of a moment of madness or a moment of bad luck, depending on how you look at the decision.
I mean, the moments of bad luck that you mentioned there, that I think that just is the kind of thing that just can happen. If you don't put the result beyond doubt, if you don't take care of the results with your performance, that kind of thing can happen. And it's happened to Liverpool twice in the past few weeks at Anfield against teams that have barely even competed during the game. You know, West Brom, the game was drifting for long periods towards the end. They ended up just sneaking a goal. And against Burnley, you know, we were faced with virtually nothing on the attacking side, but the game, you know, it weren't taken care of. It was in the balance. Anything can happen when it gets to the final 10 minutes and we give away a penalty. Whether it was a penalty or not, we're not going to get into. It's not this podcast. But I think the Burnley game for me just kind of reinforced the attack being broken for me. It was a worrying display. And I think even at the end of the game, you know, when Klopp goes onto the pitch and he greets some of his players and things like that, his head was kind of down. It was just kind of it was a bit ominous as to, is this something bigger sort of thing. But I think against United a few days later, FA Cup, obviously we lost again, but the attack felt better. It felt a bit more fluid. We obviously scored two goals. No surprise, Mohamed Salah gets both of them. But it felt like there was improvements.
Yeah, it did. Although, you know, I've been saying on the podcast for a while that I think Liverpool will benefit from playing a team who have a little bit more. I think we said it before the first United game, but obviously that panned out to be a little bit more cagey than expected. But I think Liverpool would benefit throughout this run of playing a more competitive match against the team who they may have to raise it 1 or 2%. I think we saw that a little bit because this game is a lot more open than what Liverpool have been facing over the past, you know, month. Liverpool basically been facing the same team over and over again in terms of like sitting back and, you know, soaking up pressure. It's on Liverpool to try and break them down. Whereas United, it was a little bit more open. I think it suited Liverpool because they got to produce a few more moments of magic and punish spaces that appeared. I thought Firmino's ball for Salah's face was fantastic, you know, kind of exposing that small window that opened in United defence. I thought it was telling as well, Josh. I looked this morning that this is the first domestic game since Leicester at home where Liverpool's possession average finished in the 50s. If you think of how many games has been domestically since then, you know, it was one where it was a little bit more, as I said, a little bit more equal, a little bit more open, and it allowed Liverpool to kind of hit the stride a little bit more from an attacking sense instead of facing one of these sides who just sit in and just keep everything really compact around the penalty area.
I mean, the teams that do sit in, Liverpool had, from West Brom to Burnley, Liverpool, according to StatsBomb's numbers, had 88 shots and one goal. The probability of that being the case is extremely low. And I think some of the people who've tweeted about this, I think there's actually a stronger probability that of the exact same shots, Liverpool would have bagged 10 goals than zero, which is quite a start, really. But I think if you look at the games that you just mentioned, one of the reasons I think it felt like Liverpool struggled against these teams, and it was less the case against United. So the crosses that Liverpool attempted in these games, this is according to Y Scout's numbers, which don't tend to be that great, but we'll go with them anyway. So the crosses against West Brom, 39, then 23, then 41, then 38, then 23, and then 41 against Burnley. And against United in the FA Cup, I think it was 13. So bit of a drop there, less of a focus on just hoofing the ball into the box, I suppose, from a wide area, more of a focus on movement, interplay, tight spaces, through passes maybe. But I think, as you mentioned there, it does, I suppose, stem from, you know, the better suited opponents maybe. But the only problem with that is the next two that Liverpool are going to face, we're going to preview in a minute, Spurs and West Ham. I suppose they're both inclined to again place a spotlight on Liverpool's ability to break down a block.
Yeah, and you know, that's the one caveat I have with that kind of United performance. I think, you know, it was better, definitely, and it could have went either way. In part, I thought it was a really good game. Probably deserved to be a draw, but you know, obviously United nick it. But I don't feel like we've found a solution yet. I think these next two games are bigger in terms of if you can score, you know, two goals against Spurs, two goals against West Ham, then I think you're going to start feeling a little bit more confident that the attack is back where it needs to be. And to be fair, I do think it will get there. I know it's so easy, especially if you're huge, you know, Liverpool fans like the ones listening and watching now. It's easy to hit panic stations. I must admit, I think you've been quite level-headed with it. Chris, not so much. I don't know if he'll be listening, but he's expecting the worst. But I think I see it as it will just naturally, you know, hit stride again because this team is too good and the attackers are too good for it to disappear overnight. So I don't think the reactions need to be as extreme as they have been, but I do get the frustrations. These next two games I think will be a little bit bigger in terms of finding whether Liverpool have overcome that hump a little bit or not.
Yeah, I mean, I was just looking at it as a bit of a phase up until maybe half time against Burnley. Just around that period, I was a bit like, nothing's changing here. This is the same again. Same problems again. We're not solving the problems that we're being presented with, which Liverpool have been very good at doing under Klopp. I think that was the one that concerned me above it. But the fact that we bagged two against United gives a bit of hope going into Spurs. Before we do address Spurs, just one final note on Burnley and specifically United. Reece Williams found it tricky against United. That's not his fault. But he's forced to play in a way because Liverpool don't have a backup centre-back. and they don't appear to be interested in signing one, really. There's 4 days left in the window, I think 5 days left in the window when we're recording here. Now, I think on this podcast, we generally, when there's a narrative floating around, Liverpool need a centre-back, whatever, we try to look at the other side of the coin, maybe, and talk about why Liverpool will be able to cope without a centre-back, why maybe the club don't feel you need a centre-back as much as the fan base do and all that sort of stuff. I think we've done that in past episodes, but I do think that the game against United specifically shined a real strong light on, you know, how incapable a player like that is when it comes to coping with A, managing big open spaces, and B, managing against a high quality opponent. You know, Marcus Rashford clearly causing problems, which is to be expected. He caused Trent Alexander-Arnold problems a few years back, and Trent's gone on to be one of the best right-backs in the world. But I do think the need for a centre-back in that game specifically was, it was definitely stressed. I think it was exaggerated, but I do think it was quite clear, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'll be clear from the outset. Despite what's gone on, I rarely do rate Williams. You know, I could have my eye wiped in a few years. He might go on not to be, you know, much, or maybe play at a much lower level. But when I've watched him against his peers, you know, at youth level, he looks really good. And people writing him off already, I think, are just too premature. You know, he's 19. For all the reasons you've just pointed out, Josh, it's a tough job to go into Liverpool defence and have an impact, because, you know, the way Liverpool's system is, it does tend to leave central defenders quite exposed, doesn't it? Obviously, Van Dijk can cope with that. You know, Matip can, Gomez can. Even Fabinho's proven that he can. You know, Williams can't. No matter how much kind of you're trying to get in the same system at youth level, it's a different proposition when you're doing it at Premier League. So it's just been really difficult in terms of a transition for him, because he hasn't even got things like, for me, although he's got good height, I think his body and his build, he'll pass for like a 16, 17-year-old. I think he's very lightweight at the moment. So he's just got a lot of physical development to do before he could kind of replicate a performance of a normal Liverpool centre-back. So, yeah, I think the people who were choosing to maybe talk about the need for centre-back rather than criticising Williams are right, and I'm more in that camp. I do think Liverpool could do with one, definitely. Otherwise, you're going to unfortunately come unstuck like they did to an extent on Sunday with Williams. But as I said, I don't think he should be written off yet. I think just, you know, give him time and let him develop properly. I still think he'd be a really good defender.
Are you surprised that Liverpool haven't actually went and purchased the centre-back?
I'm actually not surprised. I suppose I wouldn't be surprised if they did either, but I struggle to understand FSG. I think in terms of, I'm going to open up a can of worms here, so I'm going to be very careful. You know, I won't be on to the comments section of the thing, but I think that, you know, they clearly know how to run a business, because Liverpool are doing fantastic financially off the pitch. They've had so much success on it over the past 2 years. But I do think sometimes there's a reluctance to spend when there's a requirement. And I understand there's risks in bringing someone in now, and it could come back to bite you. But I also think we can see how the next few months are going to play out without reinforcements. And it's not going to go well, is it? Certainly feels like it won't now. So on that basis, I think one should have been brought in. And I think behind closed doors, Klopp's probably really unhappy with how it's panned out, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because you know, Liverpool generally come out with this line every summer or every window, really. When we're not doing any business, the line is usually Liverpool won't sign so-and-so position unless something changes, like a long-term injury or whatever. That's usually the line. And I think this season, that more than ever has happened. You know, Van Dijk out for the season. Joe Gomez, out for the season. Fabinho, not a centre-half. Joel Matip, injury-prone. Reece Williams and that Phillips, not good enough. And they still haven't went for a centre-back, so it's surprising. I understand the, you know, the lack of short-term thing, the avoiding short-term fixes. I am in favour of that. But I think in this situation in particular, you know, needs more sort of thing. Surely there's just some sort of six-month loan you can explore with some sort of player. I mean, for example, I don't think Chelsea would have loaned him to us, but Thiago Tomori just went on loan to AC Milan. He's a player who, you know, that standard of player would have been perfect for Liverpool. You know, just that level, get him in on loan for 6 months. We've got an established centre-half who maybe isn't Liverpool level good, but is at least a level above Phillips and Williams. And as we've said in previous episodes, I don't think Liverpool will suffer from a centre-half problem against the likes of Burnley, West Brom, Newcastle. They are games Liverpool should have won regardless. And if Liverpool had a new centre-back in those games, I don't think it would have helped much, because Liverpool's problem was in the attack. And since Matip has played in that very same attack, and it still hasn't worked. But I think specifically when Liverpool face high quality opposition, if Matip isn't playing, it is going to be a problem, because you know, Williams and Phillips will not be able to cope to the required level against top quality forwards like Rashford, like we've seen, and it only takes one moment to concede a goal from that. And I think I'm relatively safe to say that Liverpool pretty much got a very, very low chance of winning the Champions League this season if Matip doesn't play pretty much all of the knockout games. If in any of the games, any of the ties, Liverpool have to play with Williams, it's gonna be a problem. And I think in those Champions League games where it's so finely balanced, one goal can tip it and all that sort of stuff, game state, big deal, all that thing. It's gonna be tricky for Liverpool to actually lift the Champions League in particular without Matip or, you know, another centre half who's at least of a decent level.
Yeah, I agree, because it doesn't have to be. You know, we know this market isn't the best for recruiting, but it doesn't have to be a purchase for the next 4 years, or, you know, a kind of top quality centre back who Liverpool are going to be relying upon for, as I said, you know, next couple of seasons. It doesn't have to be that play. It just has to be someone who fills that gap, not even as a starter, just as a backup between now and the end of the season. And I am of the opinion that while it's not an easy job to find one, I do think you could, especially Liverpool's recruitment team. So, yeah, it's a bizarre one.
I think it's the loan I'm quite surprised by. No, a loan is not particularly problematic. It offers a short-term fix without offering you long-term problems. At the end of the season, cut ties, a little bit like Liverpool did earlier in Klopp's tenure when we got Stephen Colker in. It's very, very similar from my perspective. I don't get why Liverpool haven't done that sort of thing. As I said, I don't want to talk about it too much, because I don't think it's the overwhelming thing that Liverpool can put every bad result down to, because we should be beating the teams that we haven't beaten the past few weeks. It's just simply a case of, if Matip doesn't play and Liverpool face a top quality opponent, Liverpool are probably going to struggle. Because Williams and Phillips are quite clearly a level below the current Liverpool. It's quite clearly a weak link. And I think ahead of Spurs, who we're going to talk about now, I think Liverpool are really lucky to have Matip fit, because obviously Henderson isn't. Henderson wouldn't have been able to slot in. So it would have been Reece Williams up against, well, not up against, you know, with his teammates, but dealing with the counter-attack and threat of Harry Kane and Son Heung-min.
Analyzing Anfield on the Blood Red Channel.
So how do you see the Spurs game going then?
Yeah, I think that's it's a tough one because obviously Spurs look to be back in kind of really good form, similar to how they were before they come to Anfield. I can't remember if Liverpool set off a little wobble or they were maybe in the middle of a little bit of a wobble when they did come to Anfield, but you know, they look good again. I'm just interested to see how Mourinho will approach it because, you know, I feel like historically, from a Liverpool perspective, you see Mourinho as a bit of a thorn in the side and, you know, a kind of someone who likes to spoil the party and difficult manager to overcome. But I looked into this a little bit this morning and he's only won one of his previous 9 games as manager against Liverpool. So that's like Tottenham. I think the one win came against United and then a few non-wins in his final few matches in charge with Chelsea. So although I can't see any major tactical shake-up because he doesn't do that and he certainly won't start doing that against Liverpool, I do just wonder whether he'll have anything up his sleeve to try and, you know, try and start overcoming what Liverpool present, because certainly in recent encounters he hasn't been able to do it. Although they've been tight games, they've always been on the losing end of them.
He's played with fear, I've felt, in the past few times he's faced Liverpool and Mourinho. Like, I think specifically the first leg this season at Anfield, Spurs were on a bit of a run. I was quite fearful going into the game personally, off the counter attack and threat that Spurs offers. But he changed one or two players and just made Spurs a bit less threatened. Like, he took out Reguilon and put in Ben Davis, who's less of a problem from a Liverpool perspective. And he took out Tanguy and Ndombele and played Lo Celso and didn't play as a 4-2-3-1. I think he went with a 4-4-2. And I just felt like I could understand the reason behind using that shape and the way it was used on the day. But I just felt like it kind of nullified Spurs a little bit, and it helped Liverpool defence the way Mourinho did it. So whether he does it again, considering that Liverpool an hour away from home, and obviously Spurs are the home team, I'd be surprised if he benches Reguilon and Ndombele again, because I think those two can cause Liverpool problems. I think Liverpool, I'm not looking forward to facing the Spurs team, to be honest.
Yeah, looking at the numbers,
for goals and assists minus penalties per 90, Spurs are top of the Premier League, 3.22 per 90. That's goals and assists. And 67.7% of those goals and assists minus penalties have been posted by Son and Kane. So they are just kind of, I know they say a one-man team, but this is probably a two-man team.
Yeah, a two-man team, yeah. They're both in ridiculous form. Yeah, they both are in ridiculous form. What I really like about... I don't think roles changed too much, but what I like about Keynes is he's still kind of considered a ruthless forward, but I think there's a selflessness to his game now, where he enjoys, you know, assisting goals just as much as scoring them. And it felt like a key kind of adaptation that was needed, because everybody's been saying, you know, Kane's going to eventually drop off. Been saying for 3 seasons now that the drop-off's coming. I do just feel like he's reinvented the way he plays a little bit, his profile, and it's definitely working. It's perfect in this team. I've got it up here. 12 goals and 11 assists, which is the 5th best in Europe. They're crazy numbers now, aren't they? I know there's been penalties in there that have assisted them, but they're big, big numbers in both scoring and creating.
I mean, Spurs' attack generally, according to the league, has been relatively quiet. They currently rank 7th best attack in the league, according to expected goals per 90, excluding penalties. And for shots, they rank about mid-table, between Arsenal and Brighton for shots. So, but it stems, it's a stylistic thing. Obviously, they're inclined to soak pressure. They're inclined to sit on lead once they gain it. It's important for Liverpool not to concede first in this game. They've been sitting on leads throughout the season, a little bit less effectively lately. Conceded late against Fulham, and I've done that against a few other teams lately. They've actually barely played of late. They've only faced Wickham midweek, but that was a rotated team. And other than that, I think they've played about maybe twice over the past 2 weeks or so. So they're going into this quite fresh, and I'm a bit concerned, to be honest. It's a tricky one because Liverpool aren't the usual level, and Spurs are probably the best counter-attacking team in the league, along with Manchester United. So I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure how to take this one. I'm not looking forward to it.
I can understand that. I think maybe I've got a bit of bias in my kind of analysis of the situation because I keep expecting Liverpool to just kind of hit the stride again, and then I think when they're at the best, you know, Tottenham can't really compete. But as I said, I think there's some bias in that. I think if you're looking at it, forgetting who's who, just looking at it as team A, team B type thing, taking into consideration how both teams play, form, etc. Now, I do think there's every right to be a little bit apprehensive over this one, because, you know, Tottenham have proven to be a good team. We're beyond the halfway point, and they're still within touching distance, aren't they, of the teams at the top. You know, as we pointed out, they're really dangerous. It'll just be those tactics again, how Mourinho approaches it, that I'll find quite interesting. I'll probably get a feel for who's going to win it first, maybe 15, 20 minutes of the match.
Yeah, same. I think Spurs generally rank 15th in the table for shots faced per match, which isn't good. And according to the expected goals faced per match, though, they have the third best, which is interesting. So they rank 15th for shots faced, but third for non-penalty goals against, which obviously suggests that the shots that Spurs do face are not clear-cut. They're not tap-ins. They're not easy to finish. And that's been Liverpool's problem lately. Liverpool's problem lately has been generating those opportunities. So, yeah, it is. It's a nightmare game, this. I'm apprehensive to go towards the verdict, but just before you do, what are your thoughts on just generally on Thiago as the team's number six? Have you got any thoughts on this? Because I've seen the odd little chatter about this.
Well, I don't know if that chatter originated from TalkSport. Someone on TalkSport saying that he slows the game down, and people have kind of jumped on that a little bit. I think he definitely offers something important to the team in the sense that, you know, I think he takes the burden off Firmino maybe dropping into that 10 because he can be a little bit more imposing with his passing, you know, kind of play through the lines a little bit better. Whereas, you know, in the past, maybe like a Fabinho or Henderson, maybe looking for, you know, short passes into the feet of Firmino, who works like that. We've said it a few times, the advanced pivot type role. I think he can be a little bit more imposing with his passing. I'm still not convinced, you know, this might be unpopular to say, I'm still not convinced off the ball sometimes. I think it's a really tough job doing that number six on your own. But I think he can be bypassed a little bit too easily. He doesn't have a ton of pace. So off the ball, I don't think he's the greatest protector. But yeah, on the whole, I think it's still a pretty nice number six to have. Why have you got your reservations?
No, I think specifically with the ball, I think he's absolutely fine, doing absolutely nothing wrong at all. But I think without the ball, he has been caught a few times, and I think he's more inclined than many Liverpool players I've seen over the past few years under Klopp to go to ground, to maybe what you'd label as sell himself a little bit. And if you do get beat in those moments, you make dealing with the counter-attack trickier for your teammates. And I'm just thinking, I think specifically in relation to Spurs, I'm just thinking of how Harry Kane manages to manipulate the players around him when he's dropping deeper and Son is running in behind the opposite way. And I think if Thiago in certain moments sells himself or moves a bit forward too quickly or gets done or whatever, it's gonna leave that space for Kane. And Kane is arguably the best in the league when he's got that space to use. So it's just, as I said, with the ball, absolutely fine. No concerns whatsoever. Without the ball, I think he'd benefit from a few words from Klopp, just in terms of don't sell yourself as much, don't go to ground as much, stop slide tackling, all that sort of stuff. Just so that if maybe he is beaten by an opponent, he's not totally out the game. He can at least, you know, catch the play back up or put a bit of pressure on the shooter by tracking back or whatever. But just certain moments, I feel like he's been done and it hasn't helped Liverpool on the counter attack specifically. And I'm just thinking, yeah, I think in reference to Spurs, that's not ideal. But go on.
I was going to say, I think in terms of a really good example of someone who does what you're pointing out is, although it's in central defence, it's Van Dijk, isn't it? Where for Van Dijk, it doesn't always need to be the ball won on the initial exchange. You know, it's the first point of contact, it doesn't need to be, I need to win the challenge here. It sometimes it's just about slowing them down and other players coming into place around or killing the momentum of the attack. And I do agree that's something that he maybe needs to do a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, Liverpool have always kind of, the way Liverpool have pressed high up the field, it's always been a little bit different. I've felt to other high pressing teams like Pep Guardiola, for example. Thiago's worked under him. If City don't win the ball initially, there's usually a tactical foul that follows. And most high pressing teams have to win the ball in the highest phase, and if they don't, you know, the play has to stop or something like that. But Liverpool I've always felt Liverpool have placed a greater emphasis on just ensuring that there's always men around the ball. There's always pressure on whoever has got the ball of the opposing team. If that means reseating a little bit, if that means not diving in, not going to ground and being completely bypassed by the play, then that's what Liverpool tend to do. And I think with Thiago coming in, obviously he's world class. And Liverpool have kind of been, you know, he's been injured and stuff like that. So Liverpool haven't really had the time to bed him in slowly behind the scenes before then bringing him in like they did with Fabinho after a few months. You know, he's immediately took to the field for Liverpool. So he's still playing maybe how he would for Bayern Munich, maybe, who also press high, but a little bit differently to Liverpool. So, yeah, it's just one of them little pointers that I thought we should mention, considering I've seen a few chats on Twitter. Not a big deal, but I do think that, specifically when it comes to going to ground, maybe you should stop doing that a little bit. But in terms of the verdict for the game, then, what are you saying, Dave?
Sick of being made to be a fool in these verdicts. I'll go with a 1-1.
I thought you was holding back there.
I am playing it safe, I'll be honest.
Probably the trickiest season that I've found when it comes to predicting how football matches will go. I think generally we've been all right at it, but
yeah,
this season it's very hard. But this game, I really don't know. I really don't know. I've had the odd message in the past, the odd direct message on Twitter saying you're never going to say Liverpool are going to lose a game. If I'm going to, it's probably going to be this one. To be honest, the way Liverpool are playing at the minute, the way I know Spurs will play, I think we could get beat here again. but at the same
really,
time,
yeah.
If Liverpool turn up, Liverpool can go and win the game 2-0 comfortably. It's one of them. It's a stupid point. I shouldn't even be asking for predictions, to be honest, because it's one of them. Not like it can go anywhere, but I don't know. I don't know. We'll move on to West Ham. I'm not going to predict anything because I just don't know. I really don't know at the minute. I don't want to predict Liverpool lose because Liverpool podcast, isn't it? But I think a defeat is more possible than ever, really. while also being about as possible as a draw and a win. It'd be interesting to see what 5 days got down for. Mm. Likelihood of this, yeah, I'll double check it now, dead quick. So, according to 538, according to the performance numbers and stuff, Liverpool have a 42% chance of winning the game, Spurs 33%, and a draw 24%. Usually, to be honest, looking at 538 numbers, the way they tend to do it, that is quite close. That's about as close as Everton Leicester have got similar numbers. But yeah, it's just a really tricky one to predict, to be honest. In terms of West Ham, another game I'm not looking forward to it. I know what West Ham are like this season. I've actually been quite impressed with them this season. To be honest, Dave, I think this might be arguably the best West Ham I've seen.
Yeah, they remind me a lot of Everton in the late noughties under Moyes. I think they've got similar playing profiles. They haven't really got a standout superstar, you know, maybe midfield. But as a unit, they're excellent. I've been really impressed by them this year. I think they're a tough opponent to play against. And Moyes does, you know, for all the kind of stick he gets, he deserves credit because he's done really well with this team. I think they've recruited really well. You know, if you think of the likes of Soyuncu, he's been like fantastic, hasn't he? He's a really good in the air, a good all-round midfielder. I just think they've bought well. They've bought players in the right positions. And they're a tough side. They're more than deserving where they are on the table.
Yeah, I think they're clearly quite well coached from what I can see. And obviously they make use of set pieces, good without the ball. And I think on the break, they do actually offer a threat on the break. Like some teams label themselves as counter-attacking teams, like Newcastle, for example. And they don't actually counter-attack. But I think West Ham, they do genuinely offer a threat on the break quite consistently. You know, they've got the players for it. Michael Antonio, Jared Bowen, Saeed Benrahma, Pablo Fornals. They've got players who are decent on the break and who can get them up the field. I think Declan Rice has reached another level of late that I wasn't previously certain he would reach in the past. And I think they've also benefited from finally moving on from the Mark Noble midfield, really. Obviously, Souček's now starting every game alongside Rice. Both of them can cover ground. Both of them are quite physical. So, yeah, I think that, you know, good recruitment, well coached, problem from set pieces. And they can defend, they can soak pressure. So I think, again, from Liverpool's perspective, they're not going to be a well-suited team for Liverpool to face. Knowing what Moyes is like, obviously, you know him better than I do, Dave. You know, he's probably going to approach the game in what you would label as maybe a pragmatic way by shining a light on Liverpool's weaknesses of late, with those being an inability to find goals and break down blocks. And then he's probably going to counter-attack us and do his own set pieces.
Yeah, you know, it's worked against a lot of opponents. They've got something like the... they've got like the first possession average in the division. They're somewhere in the bottom three, I think, in terms of passing rate as well, which is obviously, you know, the number of passes they make per minute of possession. So they're right down there. It seems to be very much soak it, and they go from defence to attack fairly quickly, you know, get the ball forward. Knowing Antonio is such a hard worker, you know, he'll run the flanks, he'll run in behind, he'll drop in. He's very much like a utility player, but he's also got goal threat now as well. He's added goals to his game, so... No, he can quite easily be a problem. And then the set pieces one is big, I think, because Liverpool don't look as comfortable as they once did in terms of defending them.
It'll be interesting actually to see what Klopp does with his defence for this game, because Liverpool obviously played Thursday, Sunday this week. Matip has typically been a player who can't do that, and Matip's almost certainly going to play against Spurs, so he's probably going to miss West Ham. And that would mean maybe Reece Williams coming up against Michael Antonio, who, you know, he's a player who can bully the best defenders. So considering Reece Williams is a kid who hasn't really filled out yet, it's a tricky one. That could be a bit of a matchup to keep an eye on. I'm one that.
Who would you play?
I'd probably play Phillips over Williams in this game because I think Phillips is worse on the ball, but he's obviously more physical, probably better in the air, and a bit better suited to coping with, you know, a player as physical as Antonio. It really is a problem. Liverpool's centre of defence.
Was it against West Ham at Anfield where Phillips coming in from nowhere and had a really good like performance, man, a match performance. I'm sure it was.
That is an interesting shout. I'll check now. I'm not sure. What was the score? 2-1 Liverpool, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. The caveat is I don't think Antonio played in that game. I think he was injured. So he was up against Haller, which made it a little bit easier. But yeah, I'm sure he played really well when he came in.
Yeah, the centre of Liverpool's defence on the day was Nath Phillips and Joe Gomez up against Sebastian Haller, who was substituted around the hour mark, I think. He was 74 minutes. He was subbed for Yarmolenko. So it wasn't a great day for him, but Antonio just occupies the back line a lot better, I think. So in terms of your verdict on this one, then?
I think this is really difficult because of the Tottenham game. Obviously, it's all dependent on that. If Liverpool kind of rediscover their best form against Tottenham, then you'd fancy them against West Ham. But if they don't, I think it's another really difficult game to go into after playing Tottenham. Plus, it's away as well. That's tough. So, I'll go for... Just because I can't see Liverpool just going game after game without a victory, I'm going to go Liverpool 3-1 in this one.
From my side, I'm again finding it tricky, to be honest. I'm really trying not to be biased when it comes to making these predictions because I'm obviously a Liverpool fan. Obviously, want Liverpool to do well. Anyone that listens to this podcast will be a Liverpool fan and will want to hear positive predictions. But based on what I've seen of Liverpool of late, I'm just a lot less confident that Liverpool are going to be able to get over the line. And in this game, I actually think 1-1. If you look at West Ham's recent results, I don't think people have realised. They've won 5 in a row in all competitions, unbeaten in 7 in all competitions. And if you look at the numbers in the league, you know, they are quite strong in terms of defensive and attacking numbers, getting a bit of a balance there. So just because of what I know Moyes will do, the prospect Liverpool will face and what Liverpool will have to do to get a result here and how Liverpool are playing at the minute, I'm just not comfortable predicting the win. So I'm going to go with 1-0 for the West Ham game and for the Spurs game. Yeah, it feels like a flip of a coin at the minute. It feels like if Liverpool turn up, they could win quite comfortably. If Liverpool don't turn up, they could very easily lose. So it's a really tough period that Liverpool needs to get out of quite quickly. But we'll wrap up there anyway. So, Dave, thanks for joining us, mate.
Cheers, mate. Cheers, everyone.
You've been listening to the Analyzing Anfield podcast on the Blood Red Channel.